Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone. This is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know, and I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine for the second time today, because I don't know what happened. Thanks to my buddy, Jennifer Chapman, she informed me that my original intro got cut off. And so I'm redoing it, which is probably good because I'll get to cut it shorter. I was talking way too much. I have a guest today, and I talk about him to him and how I found him. So I'll spare you the details because you're going to hear him anyway. But I do want to say that this person, I found his, stumbled upon his work in 2016. And had I not stumbled upon his work, I probably would not have the estrogen dominance support group. I probably wouldn't be working with Ona's. So many amazing things happened because of this man's work. And funny thing is, I only stumbled upon a portion of a book he wrote that you can't even get anymore. And this man's name is Dr. Tabrizian. And a lot of you know who he is, and everyone who knows him absolutely loves him. And I just have to make a side note here about my last podcast, which was with Jason Hommel, who wrote the Copper Revolution book. And I don't want to be confusing to people, because this guest today has completely opposite purview, perspective, science, data on copper toxicity, and that there is very much such a thing. And I support Jason's research and his passion for what he's doing, and a lot of what he said resonated with me, and I definitely tried it, and I have tried some of that in the past with Morley Robbins' work as well. And I just feel like it's we have to find our own way, we have to find our own path, we have to find what works for us. And so I'm a messenger. I'm not here to say this person's right and this person's wrong. That is, for you to figure out what, like I said, what works for you and what doesn't. So back to this amazing human. He wrote this particular thing. I'm going to read it to you. It's not that long, but do get a box of tissues, because I feel like for those women, and you know who you are, when you hear this, it's going to definitely rattle your cage a little bit in an emotional way, and as it did for me. But it's a really good thing. So today he's going to talk about xenoestrogens. And when he talks about xenoestrogens, he's not just talking about plastics and chemicals and pesticides and things in our beauty products and cleaning products and pollution, although he is. But he is also talking about birth control, medicated birth control, progestins, things that are mimicking estrogen. And so that's what this particular excerpt from his book is about. And this is from Nutritional Medicine, Fact and Fiction. He says a really funny quote here, or warning in the beginning of the book. This book contains explicit biochemical pathways and therefore is not suitable for doctors. And this chapter is chapter 8, Strangers in the Night, Xenoestrogens and Health, and its effect on people, on the health of women. How would this problem manifest? Let's take a typical example. A young girl is born. She is a difficult child, fussy eater, poor sleep pattern, lots of colds. She loves chicken and craves chocolate. She has trouble with her periods for almost the onset of menstruation. They're irregular and painful, and she suffers PMT. Her doctor puts her on the oral contraceptive to suppress ovulation, and this seems to quieten things down. Eventually, she comes off the pill to start a family. Her periods take 6 months to resume, and they are worse than ever. She has trouble conceiving because the pill has depleted her zinc levels. She is low in progesterone and loses a few pregnancies at multiples of 4 weeks. She eventually gets pregnant, but her copper accumulates, and she develops postnatal depression. Her baby is zinc deficient and probably has excess copper. She tries for another baby, but this time she can't because she's developed endometriosis. Answer, the oral contraceptive. She starts to gain weight, starts to get depressed, then her skin changes. Her face develops a reddish tinge. Then she develops anxiety symptoms. She's told this is anxiety panic disorder causing her depression and is put on antidepressants, but these don't help her tiredness. Then she finds out that she's iron deficient, but she can't raise her levels with supplements. Then she's told she's got an underactive thyroid and needs thyroid replacement. Still no real improvement in energy. After a few years of this purgatory of health, she goes off the pill and develops heavy periods. She finds out that now she also has fibroids and consents to a hysterectomy. Then she discovers that her estrogen levels are low. Then the punchline, you don't have a uterus, therefore you don't need progesterone. She starts estrogen-only HRT. Despite complaining of breast tenderness, she's told to continue. One day, one of the painful lumps in her breasts is brought to her doctor's attention. She has a mammogram, then a biopsy. The pathology shows breast cancer. She has a lumpectomy with auxiliary node clearance. Her tumor is estrogen receptor positive. So then it starts chemo, then tamoxifen. 5 years later, she gets a terrible pain in the back. She has spinal metastases, more chemo, then liver secondaries. Sorry, not much more medicine can do. We've really done our best. We've followed the book, every single health recommendation. Oh, and by the way, don't go near those natural therapists. They have no idea how to help you. End of story. This case represents the full house of xenoestrogen symptoms, and unfortunately, many of the patients with breast cancer have some version of this story. Do you think that the medical professional would accept any blame for these events? Do you think that the health authorities would be interested in checking copper levels or xenoestrogens? Recently, it was found that Alcoa was burning compounds in its liquor burner that released a multitude of chemicals into the atmosphere. Guess what class of compounds these were? Yep, all xenoestrogens. Recently, PCBs were found in drain water near a toxic waste plant in the Perth metropolitan area. Guess what class of compounds PCBs are? Yep, xenoestrogens again. Do you think that the pharmaceutical companies who make oral contraceptives, HRT, or chemotherapy stand to lose or gain if doctors were made aware of these problems? No, it's probably all just a conspiracy theory with no evidence whatsoever. Or is it? So when I read that, I was moved to tears. It resonated with me. I am so blessed because I found progesterone. I found some relief before, and I had a really strong aversion to the conventional medical route thanks to my husband and my mentors. So I already didn't consent to a hysterectomy, didn't want to do the iron supplementation, didn't want to do the iron infusion. So I was really blessed to have stopped myself just by intuitive feeling about a lot of this stuff. But who's to say if I had continued to go that route, if I would even be sitting here today right now? And I know that a lot of women in the group are going through this exact scenario. We talk to them every day in the group. And so I know this is an emotional topic. And the title of this podcast is Estrogen Menace. And a lot of people are going to say, but Kitty, that's estrogen. That's not estrogen. That's xenoestrogens. But what are they doing? They're mimicking estrogen. And why is that a problem? Because estrogen is mitogenic. It causes cells to divide and grow. And so these xenoestrogens are doing the same. So it's not just the xenoestrogens. It's the fact that they're acting like estrogen. They're not acting like progesterone and causing things to be wonderful. They're acting like estrogen. That's why it says, that's why I named the title Estrogen Menace, because these things are, they've become a menace in the form of estrogen. So heavy topic. He's wonderful. You're going to love this man so much. And just as a side note, my husband had some knee surgery. Some of you know that. And he was down for the count here at home for 4 weeks. And And he was, you know, it's just the two of us in our little house and studio here, me working and recording, and he was doing some arts and crafts in the background. So, and I didn't catch it, and I was unable to really clear out the noise. So there is a lot of ambient sound in the background of my husband making art. So enjoy it and know it that that is what it is. It's the sound of creation happening in the background. And it's really funny because Dr. Tabrizian actually calls him out, and it's a hilarious moment. But all right, and so enjoy this, and I will talk to you on the backside.
Yeah.
Well, here we are,
and yes.
I have a fun story to tell you quickly. I mean, you probably don't know much about me at all, but I have a Facebook group called the Estrogen Dominance Support Group. And we have almost 40,000 members, which is pretty decent. And but the really special thing is it's like 80% active. And that's pretty special. That means, you know, all these women with estrogen dominance are coming in here. And it used to be just a certain category of women, like, you know, perimenopausal. Now it's 22-year-olds, it's parents with 16-year-old daughters. It's like, it's incredible. And which is good and bad. You know, it's good because we're out there creating a community for us, but it's bad because it's shocking to see how many young girls are suffering with this stuff. But the reason I started my group was because I was battling with major hormone imbalance and infertility. I'm now almost officially in menopause. I'm 54. And I was being passed from one gynecologist to the next, being told that I needed to be on birth control, that it, you know, if I wanted to get pregnant, I had to get on IVF. And no one could solve any of my issues. I was very, very ill and always anemic, et cetera, et cetera. I was on birth control for probably over 20 years, put on birth control at 17 because I wasn't having a period yet. And so they wanted to put me on the pill, which was brilliant, right? So along comes, I guess I started to get into the wellness field, and I just came upon this paper in 2016, July 27th, and it was this Estrogen Dominance and Mental Health by Dr. Igor Tabrizian. Am I saying that right?
Tabrizian, yeah, very Tabrizian. Good, yeah.
Taken from his book, A Nutritional Medicine, Fact and Fiction. And there's an introduction here from Christine Sutherland of Perth, Australia. And then it goes on to quote a couple of pages from chapter 8 of your book. I want you to know this was life-changing for me. And in this introduction by Christine, she even says the same thing I said here, which was that as she read this chapter in your book, she was brought to tears by it because it was her story. And this is my story, although I never was able to have children. And so I was introduced to bioidentical progesterone by you. I found Dr. John Lee because of you. I found Dr. Katarina Dalton because of you, Dr. Ray Pete because of you, and Ray White's progesterone therapy website because of you. Wow. So you are a hero to me. So I don't want to sound like a creepy stalker, but I was so excited to get this message that with your private email to contact you. So I could keep you on here for hours because I have so many questions and inquiries and just want to pick your brain. But let's go ahead and just start with what this segment was about, which was basically estrogen dominance, xenoestrogens, and health. Mm-hmm. You call it Strangers in the Night. I never have read this whole book because I can't seem to get it. Maybe you can tell us how to do that at the end of the show. But let me just throw all of what I just said into your lap and see what you have to say.
Yeah, well, really, I was always just the messenger. All of my books are really stating what is already in a public domain, perhaps simplifying some of it because some of the stuff that's out there is extremely esoteric. Like, who's going to look for answers in a journal of bioactive polymers in foods? Mm. You know, that was something that happened some time ago, and that conference led to food-safe plastics, you know, the wine glass and the fork that's embossed on the bottom of plastics. And at the time, very few people were following that. And then some larger manufacturers started to do it, you know, Tupperware, IKEA, etc. But it opened people's eyes to say, well, how long have these bisphenols and phthalates and lead been in these products causing problems? And thing about John R. Lee, I mean, he looked at it from a doctor's point of view, and he basically was the messenger. He took all of these disparate studies from obscure zoology and whatnot and put it in there. And the reason that doctors never took it on was that he didn't publish his study in a medical journal. He wrote for the masses. And to be honest, the whole point of information is to get it to the patients. If you keep it in the ivory towers, it can sit there for decades and no one's actually going to use it. But he said, what I'm seeing in my clinic is explained by this literature. Now, do you have to do double-blind randomized trials like that, especially something of estrogen dominance, which has so many different symptoms? And, you know, if you're really unlucky, you'll get all of them. You'll get, you know, the migraines, you'll get the endometriosis, and you'll get breast cancer, and then you'll get ovarian cancer. I mean, there's some people who have taken that trajectory, and the doctors who've never seen the symptom list of estrogen dominance will never go, oh my God, that's a syndrome. Because when doctors diagnose, they use a system called abjective reasoning. So it's a bit like if you've got 10 symptoms and you've got 4 out of 10, that's what the problem is. And that's because you might manifest the problem completely differently. For instance, there's a gene called HO gene, heme oxygenase 1. And if you have all the SNPs for that gene, your disease is likely to go to your breast, lung, or gut. It's
Wow.
funneled in that direction. So if everything goes wrong, you're exposed to a carcinogen. It starts to mutate. You have no switching off systems, apoptosis. And what he, the world, my world changed when I saw his studies to show that progesterone actually is anti-tumor. And if you go way, way back to pregnancy, once conception starts, that little egg is 2, then 4, then 6, then 8, then 16, it's 32, 64, etc. If you look closely at one cell, you can't tell what it is. They're all the same. So a rapidly growing thing that you can't identify looks really like an anaplastic cancer, a cancer that the doctors can't identify. So it's prone to mutating. So who comes to the rescue? The massive amount of progesterone that's being produced by the woman and eventually the placenta to say, if this looks a bit odd, terminate it. And that to me, because it was a gene, this P53 gene, and so that just changed my world when I realized that we have a system that monitors itself, and this is where the three estrogens come into it. And then he also changed my world in another book called What Your Doctor Won't Tell You About the Menopause, where he talks about why are we tarring all of the characteristics of estrogen with the color of estradiol, because that's complete rubbish. The three estrogens are not the same. And if you think about it, why would Mother Nature make a carcinogenic hormone? What is, and why would it be the highest in a woman's pregnancy? If it was causing cancer, why don't we see a higher rate of cancer in women during pregnancy? You know, it's the same with prostate. And I remember watching one of his lectures. He said, why do we remove a man's testicles in the autumn of his life when that's the lowest level of testosterone in his whole life, just to save him from prostate cancer? If testosterone caused prostate cancer, we should see it in young men. We should see it in the studs. You know, the 19, 20, 22-year-olds, that why don't we see prostate cancer then? So he was using common sense. And I think this is what put a lot of doctors offside, because they're going, gosh, this guy might be right. Why hasn't somebody published this? And it's the way that information is disseminated to doctors. It's a sad thing, but I believe that everything is connected to everything. So medicine is connected to veterinary science is connected to agriculture, agriculture is connected to soil science is connected to biochemistry, and biochemistry is connected to medicine. They're all the same thing. But when what happened in the 60s and 70s, we had online searches. When people could do these online searches, they sanitized the information that doctors were getting by creating a whole new search engine, and it was called Medline. And Medline did not search the whole scientific literature. It only searched what journals were approved by the Medline board.
Yikes.
Okay, so you're not going to see, researchers find that DDT could be responsible for Parkinson's disease until somebody sanitizes it and pushes it across, gets approval to have it put on a Medline. Then doctors are going to find it. So a lot of what John Ali was delivering was not in that search engine. The second thing that happened was, I think after, how we're changing to digital online everything. So Nature is a big journal, Science is a big journal, BMJ is actually the oldest journal, oddly enough, older than Science and Nature. And then you have the New England Journal of Medicine. So the Nature and Science have decided to digitize their entire collection. So you can go back to issue one if you want to pay for it. But the medical journals are only going back to a certain point. And I can't remember what that is. It's like the 80s or the 90s. So anything that was published before then, you will not be able to look up. I'll give you a good example. The BMJ wrote an editorial on zinc. Okay, now that's extremely unusual that any major journal would write about that. And this is 1968. And they said, well, we've looked at all these different methods of measuring it, hair samples, urinary loading, blood, all these sort of things. And we can't tell ourselves, this whole panel of British specialists, how to tell whether someone really has zinc deficiency. So our pragmatic response is, if the doctor thinks the patient is low in zinc, then the diagnostic test is a trial of zinc. And that was 1968, but you can't find that now, because the BMJ is not going to digitize its collection back to issue one. So a lot of this stuff that's there is hidden away, and you could say there's some perfidious tone to this, but it's very Orwellian. Who controls the past controls the future. So John Ali was had his he was up against the wall. He was a GP, which Jeff generally has less kudos for any reporting, even if he'd said, I have 100 patients, all of the same thing. Their disease led to a hysterectomy. The doctor says, oh, you don't have a uterus, I'm going to give you estrogen only, and then the shit happens, So that happened so many times, and it was a central archetypal thing. The typical estrogen dominance was that the condition led to hysterectomy, and the hormone therapy made it a whole lot worse. And that's what he noticed. His patients who had hysterectomies were coming in with nasal discharges and all these allergies and getting autoimmune disorders, out of sync with the median age of when that's supposed to happen, which is in the 20s. They're turning up in their 60s. So he was a curious man. So what's happened since then, that term, xenoestrogen, is very much disliked by the medical fraternity. They do not like it at all. So they had to invent a new word for them, which is endocrine disruptor chemicals. But even that doesn't describe this. It's again, it's a sanitization of something that we should all be talking about, because xenoestrogens now, if you look at Wikipedia, the classifications of them, they include mycoestrogens. So we have mold toxins that are estrogenic.
Wow.
Mold toxins. We have metalloestrogens. So we have a whole raft of metals, antimony, barium, mercury, lead. So lead dresses up like estrogen. And so it begs the question, well, how are they estrogenic? What are they? What's the mechanism of it? Now, if you read naive versions of what estrogen is, it'll say, oh, it's a hormone that creates female sex characteristics, and that's about it. And it's like saying, but what about the other 100 things that it does? It's an extreme misnomer. The name of it puts people off. And I think that's another thing that doctors think, that that's the only thing that's estrogen is estrogen, you know, estradiol. Whereas, like for instance, how would lead behave like an estrogen? So estrogen's like this big, and lead's a little dot. And you're thinking, well, on the outside of the cell, there are doorbells where hormones react. So they press a doorbell, and a noise goes on inside, like Avon calling, that kind of thing. And so, if you could go to the back end of it and short circuit it with a piece of foil, you could get the same effect, and you wouldn't have to have estrogen pressing the doorbell. And this is how the heavy metals behave as metalloestrogens. So you've got,
Metalloestrogens.
I know it's scary. Have a look at the chart on Wikipedia. I've got a screenshot over here. So they got phytoestrogens, which everyone knows about, you know, the soy, that kind of stuff. Then they've got the mycoestrogens, and they've got the synthetic estrogens. Now, John R. Lee had just scraped the surface of this problem with the synthetic estrogens, and for years, you know, he talked about DDT, and that was the major one. Now, thing about chemicals. It's probably the same in the US. It's very easy to get a chemical license for agriculture, but you need an armload of lawyers, tons of papers, to and a judge that will listen to get them struck off. It's not doctors who decide this. And so with DDT, one of the problems of DDT was it was an excellent pesticide. It really did do the job. But the problem was there was always a bit of resistance to it every year. So then the word would get around, and farmers would up the dose, the ratio that they diluted it with water. And then a few years later, they have to do the same thing because of the, it's like antibiotic resistance. You create superbugs, right? Now, the problem with that is that when the rain comes, that DDT gets into waterways and then spills into the oceans. And several continents were doing the same thing. You know, North America, South America, Africa, Asia. And then the scientists realized that the algae were being killed off by this. So instead of algal blooms, it was algaecide. And they're one of the species that are important for monitoring, controlling carbon dioxide, much like the trees. So it wasn't the fact that this is decades later, the DDT was pretty well verified carcinogen, a hormone disruptor to just about every species on the planet, that it caused mineral imbalances like copper overload. It wasn't any of those three things that got it banned. It was the fact that if we kept using it, we wouldn't have the air to breathe today that we do. That's what got it off the markets. And even then, some countries, and the WHO is responsible for this. They looked at a whole group of chemicals called the Dirty Dozens, and they omitted DDT because in the poorer countries, it's the best way of preventing malaria.
Oh my goodness.
But they're still allowed to use it. And like in the US, you had rules, you know, you couldn't use it anymore, but a factory can make DDT and sell it to a banana boat country for a reduced price on their produce. And so the FDA, I'm pretty sure, monitors chemicals that are coming in. And what opened my eyes to this was a book called Circle of Poison by Weir and Shapiro. And they were saying that in the analysis of imported food, FDA finds about 100 chemicals per year they can't identify.
Oh.
So people are tinkering with this idea of herbicides and whatnot.
Now, question about, is it showing up in hormonal defects, let's say, in other countries? Are they having just as many hormonal issues as we are here in the Western world? Do we see that?
The fertility rates are dropping in all of the countries that might be exposed to this.
Hmm.
I mean, in tropical areas, you're going to get a lot of mold and fungi, so you're getting mycoestrogens, which the WHO might not be monitoring. There's still some chemicals that are hormonally active, for instance, glyphosate. That's a bit of a controversial one right around the world. And the reason that it hasn't been removed is that they couldn't, the glyphosate works as a very specific kind of compound. It works on a particular enzyme in the plants. And we don't have that enzyme. So the judges decide, oh, well, if its target is those things and we don't have that enzyme, then it can't be dangerous to humans. It's passed through the body relatively unchanged, so it couldn't do any harm. But, if a bulldozer went through a crowd on New Year's Eve, it would pass through that crowd relatively unchanged, wouldn't it? But it caused damage on the way, and they can't get this idea that, the damage is in the throughput, because it's 50% of it's filtered by the kidney. And guess what happens when you have too much of that? Your kidneys fail. It's called a bulk
Well,
of the
are they
kidney.
not getting it, or are they just using that as a loophole? Because if it's
It's a
already
loophole.
classified as an antibiotic, glyphosate, they know that it's decimating or it's doing great damage to our microbiome at the very least, right?
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things I eluded me for years is why so many of my patients had manganese deficiency in areas where they shouldn't have. And I found papers to show that this particular herbicide binds manganese in the gut and stops it from being absorbed into the bloodstream. So I had my answer to that somewhat belated. So the chemical thing, and what we've also found is there's a lot more of the metalloestrogens out there as well. The lead, mercury. We're still finding lead in people today, children. So if you're exposed to those things in the womb, you're more likely to get infertility, a whole group of other things. So the hormone things, I mean, I'll give you an example. We had a girl who's 6 years of age going through early puberty. She had all the signs of it.
Did you
And
say
she's
6 years of age?
6 years of age.
Wow.
And she saw all the specialists. They did some hormones, or some that were slightly out, but they basically said, this is just precocious puberty. There's no explanation for it. But, when you hear that thing, we don't know what it is, it's a bit of a red rag to a bull for me. We actually found out that this girl had the highest level of glyphosate we've ever seen in a human.
Wow.
Okay. And we know there are studies to show that people with similar issues have exactly the same problem. And it's an endocrine disruptor. And it and lead actually act in a similar way, and they influence how the pituitary talks to other glands. And some people are more genetically prone to this. There are certain genes that create a lag time between ovarian release of hormones and pituitary response. Normally, it's like an hours, minutes or hours, the two can send an email to each other. But in some genetically predisposed people, and there's a gene called the LHCGR, if you have the full SNPs for that, then the lag time is days, so it's elongated. And so what happens is that after ovulation, there's a elongated time where the ovary still thinks it's supposed to make estrogen, until it realizes, oh my God, hang on, oh, we've overdone it by a week. So you get this high level of estrogen. And the problem with estrogen, a part of its other characteristics is it's pro-inflammatory. And anything that pretends to be estrogen is pro-inflammatory. And that's why you only ovulate with a peak once a month, because there's no way your immune system could handle it for 28 days straight. It would kill you. And so Mother Nature says, look, I'm going to give you one shot at this. You can peak your estrogen, 1400, I don't care, get pregnant. But if you do get pregnant, I'm going to damn well make sure that you have the anti-inflammatory antidote so that you don't kill the kid or yourself. And that's progesterone. So the two peak in parallel, that's if you can make progesterone. But let's say you had this problem of estrogen dominance and you were the group where you couldn't make progesterone. You've been exposed to DDT in utero and you get this primary ovarian failure. You wouldn't be able to keep up with the rise in estradiol, and then your immune system would be so crazy that it had no moderators in there, and it would say, let's kill the kid. And this is where you get these miscarriages, you see. If you can't keep up, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, Eisenhower's thing. So, you can see how that can create miscarriages. And why so many women have, if they don't have this parallel rise of progesterone with it. And that's how important it is. So the progesterone's there to make sure that the rapidly turning, dividing cells don't turn into some mutation. And they found this out the hard way. When they were doing IVF initially, they refused to believe in bioidentical progesterone. So they used a progestin when they were giving the woman, estrogens and all those sort of things. And guess what happened? Their babies turned out with bladder cancer. So you're thinking, what the hell is going on? And then I thought, oh, maybe that's not physiological. Maybe we should be giving the real progesterone. And as soon as they switched, they didn't have that problem. So it just goes to show how important the anti-tumor apoptotic effect of progesterone is anytime. And so what John R. Lee was saying was that, look, if you take out a woman's uterus, she still needs progesterone because 20 men need progesterone too. And that's the dumbest name they could have given that hormone, progestation, because, and probably estrogen is a pretty dumb name too, estradiol, because it doesn't really reflect what it does, in across, a non-gender bias. So you can see that the teaching of these things has led to a blind spot by doctors. And they think, oh, it's all okay, to prescribe estradiol, which is the most carcinogenic of the three. And, John R. Lee, in the other book, What Your Doctor Won't Tell You About the Perimenopause, was talking about the importance of balancing the three of them, E1, E2, E3, plus progesterone, plus that group had to be balanced with the androgens. So what you have then is the estrogens, progesterone, androgens, and cortisol in a tetrahedron that needs to be monitored all the time. If that tetrahedron gets out of shape, you're going to get allergies, impaired immunities, cancers, and autoimmune disorders, because the hormones have so much say about this. And we found the same thing with the microbiome. The microbiome has a huge say on how the immune system reacts or not reacts or overreacts, all of that kind of thing. But that's almost what's the word? That's like a foreign language talking about lactobacilli and bifidobacterium to doctors. They need to revise it. It needs to be somehow reported. And the problem is that the people who tend to report this are writing for the lay public. It's like winemakers. Do they wait, make wines for the judges, or do they make wines for consumption by families around the dinner table? There's a polarization of that. You've probably seen it.
So When we talk about estrogen as a carcinogen, I guess there's this tug of war going on right now because of the Women's Health Initiative, and then all of these doctors across the world and the NHS pushing for estrogen and saying, the WHI was demonizing estrogen and we need to stop that. And it just seems like a very interesting marketing campaign going on right now with the Sarah Gottfrieds of the world and all these famous doctors and these and the NHS and Canada as well, where they're saying Marina Coil to protect the uterus, estrogen for women who are in peri and meno, and coupled with like Marina Coil. And some are talking about progesterone, but it's an afterthought, right? They're not talking about the balance. So I'm trying to find, and I'm fighting, and I'm little old me over here. I'm trying to fight for a to skew the perspective of how people are looking at it, and rather being like estrogen is a carcinogen and progesterone is the savior, or vice versa, or whatever, forgetting about progesterone altogether. But to say what you were saying about the balance, that tetrahedron of balance, and that estrogen is mitogenic, right? Its job is to divide and grow. And that progesterone, I always say the lion tamer and the lion, and progesterone is the lion tamer. And it's there to modulate and to help keep from randomly differentiating these cells and creating havoc in the body. But that estrogen is so necessary, right? It's so important and essential. So it's not like we're demonizing estrogen. But what I find interesting is like, is there some intelligence behind progesterone? Because estrogen's randomly doing this. It'll do it, it'll grow bone, it'll grow tissue, it'll grow everything. And progesterone comes in, and I read it can be catabolic, but it can also be anabolic. Like it's got this intelligence to it. What is that? Is that a, yes, it's a chemical messenger, right? But like, is there microbiome activity there? Like, why is there this intelligence behind progesterone? I know that's an esoteric question, but give it a go.
There's a bit more to it, and that's because progesterone can be on converted to other things like allopregnanolone, and that compound is what stimulates GABA receptors in the brain. So it's a natural Valium, like the neurotransmitter GABA. Progesterone, not directly but indirectly, and that allopregnanolone, they're actually done studies on that to prevent postnatal depression. So they give women injections of it to. So these are neuroactive steroids, and something that isn't. It is not taught, and I don't know why, but the brain makes its own steroids. So, for instance, DHEA, which is one of the intermediates, so for some people, when progesterone is produced, it'll either go to DHEA or it'll go down to cortisol. Now, if you're stressed, you're going to siphon off your progesterone just to make cortisol. So you instantly create an imbalance just from that. And so, unless you can tool up and make extra progesterone to cope with it, you're not going to do it. The next thing is that there's a spectrum of sensitivity of progesterone receptors, rather like vitamin D. So for some people, they can have an atom of vitamin D in their bloodstream and that'll press the doorbell. But for some people, they have to use a sledgehammer to, get the vitamin D to make a noise inside the cell, because vitamin D is actually a steroid as well, you see. The same with progesterone. There's a gene called the PGR. And if you have a relatively insensitive PGR, you need your feedback loops to make more progesterone. And that won't work if you're siphoning it off to cortisol. Second thing is that dopamine, these hormones are influenced by the neurotransmitters. So there's an overlap between neurotransmitters and hormones. For instance, serotonin will increase estrogen levels. And the proof of that was that when women were throwing away their scripts for HRT, the doctors go, "Oh my God, we've got to give them a tablet because that's what they've come for. What are we going to give them?" So they gave them SSRIs. And it worked because it raised the serotonin, which got them to raise their own estrogens because it was a neuro hormone. So progesterone has the same relationship with dopamine. And this is how chase tree works. So we know how women take chase tree because I don't want to take bioidentical hormones. I just want a herb.
I like your American accent whenever you kind of say silly things. I won't take offense.
Oh, that's not deliberate. All right, I'll go back to normal. I don't want to have people having hate mail say, I hate your accent. I come from that town. Laramie, isn't it? You're trying to make it sound like you're from Laramie. Anyway, so
I was born in El Paso, and I'm not taking it.
Oh, okay.
So it's all good.
Yeah. But tell me, why are all the capital cities so small in America? Like Austin, for instance, you've got San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas. How come Austin gets, you know, the bee's knees? And Sacramento, California, seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, digress. So where was I going?
Yeah, so, the doctor gives them a
dopamine
pill.
But now here's the rub. Some people are insensitive to dopamine. They have the same problem. You can scream all you like with your dopamine, but it won't work. So then you try to raise the dopamine to fix the progesterone, but the dopamine receptors won't be listening. And that's called the DR2, DRD2, dopamine receptor D2. So there's an influence of genes, and some women will not make estrogen from progesterone because they don't have the enzymes that will go, oh, goody, we're lacking estrogen, come down this pathway. And this is where progesterone therapy sort of came to a bit of a cul-de-sac because people were using it, but they didn't know all of the parameters that would generate its success. Okay, so you've got the progesterone receptor, you've got dopamine receptor, you've got the enzymes that convert progesterone to DHEA, and then enzymes that convert DHEA to testosterone and testosterone down to estradiol. So there's a lot more ifs here, and that's why progesterone therapy sort of dropped to the wayside, because nobody thought, oh, there's something we're missing here. It looks so obvious that if you give this, you must get this. And it's the same with vitamin D. People go, oh, the studies don't seem to show such a strong influence. Well, you know, did you check the genetics of the receptors? Because you're going to need a lot higher dose than people who can't hear the bloody thing.
Wow.
Okay, so you see how if you don't have all the facts, it's very easy to discount something. Because you just go, oh, that's too hard. And especially when there's multiple parameters, that is really hard to study. You know, I have to be honest about that. You know, it's very hard with multi-parametric things to find out, well, did it work or not? John Ali seemed to be very keen that it did. But sometimes this is where the problem arises when you don't do peer review. And that is that if it didn't work, he wouldn't mention it. Because the patients might not come back. You know what I mean? Some of them do. It's a 50-50. Some will come back and complain and say, that didn't work. I want something else. And some of them will just go, I'm not going back to him. I'm going to give him one star on Facebook. So, you know, if you study, if you follow them up in a peer, and this is where I think the problem was more obvious down the track. And the thing about him as a visionary, he knew the answer before he started. Yeah. Are you making a cappuccino?
He's making a cappuccino. My husband had knee surgery, and he's down for the count for 6 weeks. And he's here with me while I'm working.
Oh, no.
So he's doing art projects over there.
Oh,
he asked me if you were making a cappuccino. Okay.
With organic coffee, of course. Mount Shasta. Yeah. It's got more complicated. You know, now they've added metalloestrogens, microestrogens. When I looked at this, I thought, oh no, how am I going to cover this? But the basic thing is there that anything, so yes, the estrogen's been much maligned, but the problem was that medicine has this, we don't like to change what we do because it seemed to work. I mean, like And same with dentists, for instance. Look at amalgam fillings. We've been using this for 130 years and we've never seen a problem. And the reason is that they're not doctors. They don't see the problems of their amalgam fillings. We see the problems of their amalgam fillings. Anyway, that's another rabbit hole if you want to go down. So, yes, estradiol, is maybe carcinogenic. It's mitogenic. And people equate that. Like, for instance, the amount of trouble that doctors go to suppress estrogen levels in estrogen positive cancers, both in males and females. And one of the real eye openers of his book was you could see estrogen dominance in males, and I definitely have seen that. It's not just that, because the exogenous estrogens add up to the endogenous estrogens to create the total estrogenic load.
Right. This is a great tiny little segue here. Because I always say in my group that estrogen dominance doesn't equal excess estrogen. It just it can even be really low levels, like in menopause, but you can have zero progesterone. Absolutely. And this can be creating symptoms. And so I always think about men and when they start to age and how they start to kind of feminize. Even though they might have low levels of estrogen and testosterone and everything, they start to feminize, don't they? And to some degree,
that could be the absence of testosterone too, because of the tetrahedron. So that, and that's one of the reasons, they get more cancers as they get older.
Yeah.
As well. So that tetrahedron is so important. What, I don't know how to, I don't know, maybe we should get some of those t-shirts, I love estrogen or something, handing them out. But yeah, it has been much maligned, a bit like copper. I've had patients who read my book, chapter on copper, and go, that's me, you're writing about me. And
right.
I felt like, Jack Nicholson in that movie, Something's Got to Give. No, As Good as It Gets. Where he said, I think of a man, then I take away accountability and reason. Do you remember that line
No,
you have to watch it.
I saw it, but it was ages ago. Well, before we jump into copper, let me ask you about this: the xenoestrogens on its impact on like gender fluidity and gender confusion and the feminizing of so many young men. Do you feel like that definitely has an impact, or do you think that is more to do with just cultural things?
Oh, absolutely. No, if you're exposed to estrogens in the womb, for instance, or xenoestrogens, that definitely changes the brain's pattern. Recently, they found that a woman's MRI changes over her cycle. So within days. Now, if you, even Norman Doidge would be overjoyed and horrified by that, the one who wrote The Brain That Changes Itself, the neuroplasticity. No one ever thought that these hormone changes could actually change the thickness and the balance of white matter and gray matter. And
so it's the brain. Hip-hip. You're saying an MRI on the brain.
MRI. They did serial MRIs on women going through their cycle, and the brain visibly changes.
Wow.
Okay, so the MRI is a resolution down to about a millimeter. So something that makes – there's a difference going on in the brain as a result of hormones. So in the – and that's with the blood-brain barrier up and running. So you can imagine before day 24 – wherever it comes up, that any hormonal influence is going to imprint on that template and then later on. So you can have all the XY chromosomes you want, but it's not necessarily, going to create a, heterosexual brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a study, and I was looking for this the other day, where they try to elucidate, is there a female brain in men? So that, how there's a relationship between the follicle stimulating hormone and estrogen. There's the pituitary says, make some estrogen, get back to me, and estrogen says 1400, nanomoles per liter. Oh yeah, that cool man, that'll do. Well, but then if you give estradiol to him, and you'll suppress the FSH because it'll go, yes, we got the message. We don't need to do that. Well, if you, they gave estrogen to gay men who had identified with, being attracted to other males, and they found the same thing. The hormone went down exactly as it would with a female. So there's some physiological verification of this. It isn't just, I was kissed by my friend when I was 4, and I realized I like boys, that kind of thing. It is not just this environmental effect. There's something really happening, and so that can be anything that's estrogenic. Maybe it isn't even estrogen, because there are actually xenoandrogens, believe it or not. So they've invented another thing. So that's another channel you can run on YouTube, the androgen dominant syndrome. Anyway, yeah, so now there's xenoandrogens, and it just, the more scientists look at this, then they're collating and writing papers and all this sort of stuff. But it isn't getting into the medical lexicon. Even the endocrinologists aren't kind of got their finger on the pulse of this. Well, yes, there's the I mean, how long has this been sort of going on? I mean, Virginia Woolf wrote that book, Orlando. Did you read that? Yeah. And so, is it that programmed to come back as something or another, or is there some other influence? Or, but we do know that all these hormones are additive, and when it gets to a certain point, they block the corrective mechanisms to fix it. For instance, let's say you did have excessive amount of estrogen-like compounds, you'd want your liver to get rid of them, and so there's a series of steps that break them down. And they involve, certain genes, certain cofactors, and some people, women and men, have defects in these pathways that either create carcinogenic estrogens from an overproduction by their genetics. Some of the cytochromes, I think the 1B1, that one, or they can't break it down because they have an issue with an enzyme called NQ1. That's sort of the last straw. And NQ1 is a enzyme that converts inactive CoQ10 to active CoQ10. So there's two types of coenzyme Q10 available to us: the inactive form, which is the ubiquinone, and the active form, which is the ubiquinol.
Ubiquinol.
And some people genetically can't convert that. And if you're one of them, you're definitely looking at a rise in the 4-hydroxyestrogen group.
So interesting, these genetic factors,
It's
because
big,
it
yeah.
seems they've always been there. Like we're born with these things,
Yeah.
but this epigenetic factor that comes in and, like, I don't know, flips it on, let's say, because I have a lot of different genetic SNPs, like the vitamin D one that doesn't allow me to absorb,
Yeah. Yeah.
convert at like
Yeah.
three different steps of the vitamin D.
Yeah. Yep.
And why do I have that? I've had that, so I was born with it. And why do I have that? Who knows? But is it really playing any role in my health until something goes wrong? Like I'm fine, and then all of a sudden, I have too many xenoestrogens. I'm eating loads of
Yeah,
pesticided
yeah,
food,
yeah.
and then all of a sudden, that epigenetic factor flips on this vitamin D issue, and all of a sudden, I'm starting to get sick all the time. So let's say
So
that,
maybe your family came from a coastal area where they had a lot of oily fish, because that could contain enough vitamin D. With a good microbiome, the oily fish could compensate for some of those genetic issues.
I'm Basque, Spanish Basque, so that's mountain, Pyrenees, and then I'm American Indian. But maybe, I don't know, somewhere in there, back, who knows? You
Yeah.
adapt these different SNPs. Well, that's
You're
interesting that.
compensatory, yeah. Maybe the other genes are compensating for it, like the conversion from other steroid hormones to vitamin D. There's a few pathways that haven't. I mean, there's 255 steroid hormones, so there's a bit of a, it's a big factory, and the brain makes them. And what I was trying to say is that of that hormone DHEA, the brain makes 50% of all the DHEA in the whole body.
Wow.
And so the neurosteroids, the effect of xenoestrogens will kind of depend on what tissue they wind up in. You know, if it's the brain that has a certain pattern to it, like migraines, for instance, if it's in bone, for instance, it'll cause a different problem, like, you know, osteoporosis. So I don't know the answer to undemonizing estradiol. I think maybe just got to have a, you know, we'd have a royal commission on it here, but you don't have a king. So you've got to think of some other think tank and just get everyone around the table and say, look, let's just reset and start again with this hormone.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that, I don't think that, I think they're doing a good job, this new marketing campaign, I'm calling it, of trying to stop the demonization of estrogen, because that's all I ever see anymore is, you know, estrogen's good, estrogen's good, estrogen's good, but then they leave out the progesterone. So I'm convinced that it's a pharmaceutical effort behind this, just trying to, you know, sell the
they
estrogen.
The pharmaceuticals have got fairly clever about this because they put bioidentical progesterone on the marina, and they also created micronized progesterone as a capsule. So the way that it works is if you can have a novel delivery system, you can patent that particular thing. So for instance, if you had a progesterone vape, some of the big guys, guys could go that and go, all right, or a progesterone wafer, you know, put under the tongue, like migraine tablets, or what else?
A sucker.
Do?
A sucker. That'd be a good idea.
Lady shakes.
Lolly.
You know.
That someone was saying a progesterone patch would be as big as your back. You'd have to roll it out like wallpaper onto your back. Well, so what did you, I want to get off of that subject because we could talk all day about that really, but, let's talk about the copper now. So something that I found super interesting, but because I didn't have the whole book, I didn't understand what it was about. I just understood that it was me. And which is basically the story that you tell here about the example, the demonstration of the little girl, the fussy eater. But it starts off by saying a young girl is born, and I'm going to read this after you and I get off of here. I'm going to read this, if you don't mind, to my people, because it's just so profound. But basically it says a young girl is born. She's a difficult child, fussy eater, poor sleep pattern, lots of colds. She loves chicken and craves chocolate. What is the significance behind that? Why did I love chicken and crave chocolate and still do?
There's a few things that are in there. The first thing is that her copper was high. And normally what happens is by the age of one, the liver copper should be the same as an adult. So they did studies on mammals and they did liver biopsies. And they found that all mammals have much higher copper levels than adults in terms of concentration because breast milk is relatively copper poor, but it's got lots of zinc in it, and zinc and copper don't agree. So Mother Nature says, look, we need the zinc because it's going to make you grow and protect your immune system. Zinc deficiency creates abnormal tastes and smells, so we want to make sure that you're going to eat everything that's on your parents' table. You know, we're going to set you up. Until you're weaned and eating properly. So we're going to make sure that your liver has lots of copper so you don't run out. So we're going to put it in the liver. And that's why estrogens raise copper levels, because it's preparing the child for that hiatus between being fed by the placenta and eating real food. And all mammals do this. That's it. As long as you've got lots of glutathione in your system, you can make lots of glutathione, then you will get rid of that copper by 1 year of age, and you won't have that problem, you know, from that point on. The problem is that some people can't make enough glutathione on demand, and they certainly can't make it if they have heavy metals like mercury in their system as well. There's a
Or they were on baby Tylenol their whole young
con
life.
conflict of interest. Yeah, that's right. So, then the first thing, the fussy eater part is because the zinc level's low, and that affects their olfactory system. Like, food doesn't taste. You don't know. That's not true. You don't get the aroma of food when you're zinc that low. You get taste, so you're stuck with sweet, salty, bitter, and sour. And most kids won't go with sour or bitter, so they go with salty or sweet. So they're generally it'll be one of those two. You know, they're craving chips or they're craving the chocolate. And the other thing about the chocolate is it's a quite a good source of tryptophan, which is converted to serotonin. And the problem with high copper is that it blocks the conversion of tryptophan through to serotonin and melatonin. So when the copper's high, you can't make serotonin. So you've got a you're irritable, problems with behavioral regulation, often issues with temperature control. You know, their little kids are running around in shorts and singlet in the middle of winter, going, "Oh, can I go in the pool?" And I'm going, "Put some clothes on." So they have the serotonin deficiency. So chocolate is probably the easiest thing to help increase the tryptophan levels, so the craving for it. And it's sweet because they don't have the aroma of food, but they can taste the sweetness of the chocolate.
Interesting.
I
I
think
had
that
a
is that all the symptoms? Picky eater, sleep
Oh,
disorder.
that she has? No, it goes on. Of
They
course,
often,
trouble with her periods and the onset of menstruation, irregular, painful. Yeah, goes into the hormonal stuff as a puberty after puberty. I had a gentleman on my podcast recently. I'm going to air that tomorrow. He studied copper. He studies copper, and he had a very interesting take on copper. He was saying that there is no upper limit of copper that's toxic, and he said that almost everyone is deficient, and that we should be definitely taking copper. And it was convincing to me in many ways. And he said, all the papers are saying that, like people with certain types of mental illness have high copper levels in their brain, but they don't talk about how maybe that the copper is there to try to mitigate some of the damage of whatever else is going on. And then he said, if copper is so toxic, why do they give it to poison? It's a poison control thing. When someone ingests something that they shouldn't and it's poisonous, that they give them this drink that's like high copper content to make them vomit. And he said, if it's so poisonous, yeah, it might make you vomit, but why would they give it to even a child to make them sick? So he was trying to prove his point in defense of copper and saying there is no upper limit. What do you say to that?
Everything has a sweet spot. Blood pressure, pH, sugar. So I think that's quite a naive view of copper. What sometimes is incorrect is the copper the problem or the cause of the high copper is the problem? So sure, you can see copper deficiency. I mean, they put here's a really good example of this. Have you ever been to a vineyard and you've seen the little grey tins they have at the end of the vines? They have copper in those tins so that the vines can get the copper. But when they have pests, they spray the pests with copper oxychloride, which is the Bordeaux mixture. So there's a sweet spot. Okay, there's a sweet spot, isn't it? They don't want them to be deficient, but they're quite happy to spray the pests that get on the vines. So the Bordeaux mixture is copper oxychloride. So we're kind of the same. We need now. One of the things they found was in at least in cows was that the higher the copper intake, the liver just absorbs all the copper. It's a linear relationship. So oral intake and liver copper are almost non-saturable. Okay, so it appears, at least in that organ, that high levels of copper aren't a problem because it's n usually having it can handle those things. The problem we have is we don't always get a good a good feel for the intake of copper. For instance, with copper pipes, because copper can be absorbed as ionic copper, it can be absorbed from the upper gut, like the esophagus. Whereas when you ingest copper in foods like in chocolate or avocados, nuts, seafood, that sort of thing, it takes hours to absorb the copper because you've got to undo the chelate, transport it across, and then there's a thing that says that's enough. You don't need any more copper. Thanks very much. So there are checks and balances, but not for ionic copper. Now, he might not be aware that some time ago in Portland, Oregon, which I know is not the capital, because it rains all the time there, their dams are always full, you know. And what happened one season, it didn't rain so much. It was sunny skies and the dam levels fell down, and they had problems with algae. So when you have problems with algae, you use copper shock, right? Because copper kills the algae. This is why they, have to be so careful about it. But the problem was, and then, yeah, so they had this sunny day. I've gone to the punchline. So they had all these sunny days, and they found that in that city, the crime rate was going up. Domestic violence, robberies, homicides, all these sort of things. And they asked the psychiatrist, "What's going on?" They said, "Oh, it's because it's unusually sunny. People aren't used to that. It's throwing out their circadian rhythms." And then somebody said, "Nah, I don't think that's the case." And they found out that the person who was running the dam had used too much copper because they looked it up and they'd never done it before in the whole history of, the water authority, and they got the concentration wrong. And they put too much in there, and the high levels of copper did affect the mental state of the people in Portland, Oregon. And there are cases of children eating, the case in Emsley's book, a child ate the copper sample in a chemistry kit and died. So he's not really fully aware of all of the mistakes that have happened with copper. But one thing is correct, that sometimes, because copper is an alkaline mineral, it's used to keep the peace. It's also an antibiotic. So, for instance, if you're sick, what happens is the bacteria that are trying to get you, they're after the iron. So the spoils of war are iron. So what you do is you hide the iron, the serum iron goes down, you put it into canisters, to keep it hidden from the gut, these bacteria called ferritin. It's in a canister, and you raise the copper because copper's an antibiotic, and there's a whole heap of antibiotics that we make, cathelicidin, beta defensin, a whole range of these things that we actually make, hepcidin. So until the threat goes away, then you can bring the copper down, take the iron back out into the bloodstream. So if you do have a chronic infection, the copper might be raised just because of that, because you're under threat.
Well, that sounds like it can be, so there's like a holding tank for the copper, and then there's like a bioavailable, and I know that's a ceruloplasmin, I guess. So is it the bioavailable copper that's causing the mental issues when people have too much, or is it that storage form of the copper? So maybe he's saying you can have as much of the storage form, but if your body, I don't know, makes it too bioavailable, it'll make you crazy. I don't know.
People, there are diseases of heredity that people overstore copper, and they definitely get mental health issues with that. But then a woman's copper is the highest in her whole life during pregnancy. It goes well above the reference range, and most of the time that doesn't cause a problem. And I think because copper has this obtundant effect on neurotransmitters, that's one of the reasons that estrogen increases cognitive capacities, maybe to compensate for this, the pregnancy brain that people talk about. It shouldn't happen. According to the MRI studies, there's an increase in cognitive capacity under the influence of estrogen. I'll send you this study if you want to have a look at it, because it was a real eye-opener to me, that could prove that brain changes within days. And that's really, everyone is quite skeptical about it, but It's actually
So what
true.
are you saying? You're saying that so when a woman is pregnant and she's having these things with her head, with her brain and misplacing things and whatnot, that it's because of the high estrogen levels in the brain or during
There's a
pregnancy?
copper. Could be the copper.
Oh.
The estrogen's there to keep her on her game. You
Okay.
don't want to slip in the shower. You don't want to have a car accident. You don't want to, cut through your foot with the axe when you're chopping the wood. You want to be on your
Right.
game when you've got a baby.
Hmm.
Why? There's no survival advantage in pregnancy brain, the things that people talk about,
Yeah,
cardiovascular brain.
I would have thought that it was because of progesterone deficiency while pregnant. Like, a lot of times here's something that always happens we hear is that the doctors will take the women off of progesterone after the first trimester because the placenta is now making progesterone for them and they don't need it. And I always say, well, okay, maybe the placenta is making progesterone for the pregnancy, but what about the woman? What about her needs for progesterone and her estrogen in her brain?
Exactly.
Doesn't she still need it? So I always say stay on progesterone throughout your pregnancy so you can avoid PND and all the things that happen because of estrogen. So I would have thought that pregnancy brain had more to do with that, but
It's
interesting.
more to do with the, well, from what John Ali described, he was talking about anxiety and depression being part of the estrogen dominant syndrome. The cognitive issue, there's another reason why it might be, and that's homocysteine. Okay, so homocysteine is an intermediate amino acid. It's a bit like a Newton's cradle. If you kick it one way, you get SAMe. If you kick it the other way, you get glutathione. So as long as you keep it going, it's fine. Homocysteine never builds up. And this is why, and they never tell you this, but this is why women get folic acid in the first 2 trimesters of pregnancy, because some 30% of females get higher homocysteine, and one of the symptoms of high homocysteine is brain fog. Now, that having d done that in so many people, the folic acid doesn't solve the homocysteine problem in a certain group, and that's because there are other influences on homocysteine and methylation than just the MTHFR genes. There's a whole raft of them, and the reason for this is methylation is so important. You cannot afford to drop the ball. So you're going to have 10 pathways that can methylate in case 2 of them are defective or just slower than others. It's kind of a team thing. And the others muck in more. They do more hours if the other ones are a bit retarded, say. So you've got trimethylglycine, you've got serine, you've got lipoic acid. You've got choline. There's a whole lot of other things that are involved in keeping this methylation running than just folic acid. It's a very naive biochemical and incorrect biochemical view that folate and even methylated folate is going to keep the homocysteine down. And one of the things they found in studies in chronic fatigue syndrome, for instance, when they did lumbar punctures, they often found the homocysteine extremely high in the CSF, which is bathing the brain, but not necessarily in the blood. So this can happen in a regional sense, and it's because different tissues control homocysteine in different ways. So they're making predominantly it's to do with glutathione pathways. And so a liver will do it differently from a red blood cell, that'll do it differently from a lymphocyte, it'll do it differently from a glial cell, will do it differently from a kidney cell. They'll m manage the problem through different biochemical means depending on their taste. So it's a bit like a curry. Okay, so glutathione is a curry. Well, what type is it? Is it Goanese? Is it Japanese curry? Is it, Sudanese? Is it, Thai? Everyone uses the same term, but actually the construction of it is quite different. So glutathione is a bit like that, see? So in the brain, the most important thing about the glutathione is that you've got to be, like, when we weren't exposed to heavy metals, we'd never had this problem. As soon as the heavy metals started coming on board, we had the problem. And the classic description of this is the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire, one of their problems was they had lead encephalopathy, which is a type of dementia. This is one of the supposed reasons for the downfall of the Roman Empire, because they all went a bit gaga They had aqueducts. They used to sit in baths. They loved sweet wines. And one of the ways to make wine sweet when it's not is to boil them in lead pots because lead has a certain sweetness to the wine. So
Wow.
they're all guzzling all this stuff, right? And people go, oh, yeah, but they weren't like a big civilization. That's complete BS. The Romans mined 80,000 tons of lead every year. 80,000 tons of lead every year that there was a dynasty.
What?
Not just one year or in the total amount, but every year. And this is why they
Wow.
invaded other countries like Romania, because they wanted the minerals. They wanted the, think of the name, Romania. Where did that come from? Romans, you know. The silver, the tin, all of these things, they were maniacs when it came to engineering and stuff like that. So we know that this has begun at least at that time, that these things, metals, mercury, lead, whatever, have been exhumed from the earth and exposed to the rest of us. And our physiology was not meant for that. We're, probably hundreds of thousand years behind in the evolution of keeping up with it. And there's going to be a tipping point at one time where the exposure, like in utero, might create problems. And we passed that in the 70s.
Yeah, wow. I didn't
Yeah.
realize it was that long
Yeah.
ago.
Yeah. Now we're seeing it. Like, look at the rise of, cancer, seeing adult diseases in children. We're seeing a rise of, delinquency, illiteracy, behavior issues, ADD,
Autism, yeah.
ADHD, autism, etc. If you look, the gene pool's been relatively stable. So what's going on? The CDC would say, oh, that's an environmental issue.
Yeah.
So
Wow.
it must be environmental. Something we've done to this planet is biting us back.
And the
So I didn't mean to get into
homocysteine going, no, that was good. That's so
that.
true. And I didn't realize it was that far, that long ago. But I'm
Absolutely.
thinking about like when I was born in 1969, and I definitely, my father was in the military, so I had every possible vaccine and then some. I got extra credit for getting everything because we were traveling everywhere, and I was so sick. And then I, lost all my baby teeth would just rot and fall out of my face, and I would have, metal. I had amalgams and silver crowns on baby teeth. Okay, that was crazy. And so I know for a fact that I was having major metal issues, and that was the very early 70s, and still probably dealing with that to some degree, and probably played into everything else, right? Yeah, something went very wrong. And so the homocysteine, high homocysteine in pregnancy can also maybe be contributing to like severe like hypermensis gravidarum with the morning sickness. And you think that plays a role with that as well?
Yeah, they're still trying to figure out what it is. And maybe that's why B6 works in some women when they give them B6 because they're already taking
B6, yeah.
folate. And then, B6 and ginger.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah, I've been
absolutely.
recommending that a lot along with more progesterone. So let's talk about progesterone. So I love, and I know I've kept you over almost an hour and a half. I hope that's okay. I can wrap it up soon, but I do want to ask you about the progesterone. So I, a doctor, not doctor, a Mark Newman who owns Precision Analytical, who does the Dutch labs, he just came out with this statement not too long ago, some literature saying that because topical progesterone doesn't show up in dried urine or in urine labs, that it doesn't protect the uterus. And so he doesn't recommend doing it. So Mark doesn't recommend using it. And so Mark Newman said so. Of course, my life was saved, like I said, starting with finding out about you and then using NAPRO, topical progesterone, that stopped my, heavy, heavy, heavy bleeding and clotting. And I, always tell my women this, that it I actually passed a decidual line, uterine lining. And my gynecologist at the time said that didn't happen. She literally said that didn't happen, and that topical progesterone is not usable. So, I just say, look, we have to find what works for us because some women have more receptors than others. Some women have hypothyroid, they have candida, they have. So that's how you feel, I'm gathering. You feel the same
Okay.
way.
So when you urinate something, it has to be in solution in the bloodstream to go to the kidney. And so the kidney either decides, it's a weird system. It says, right, I'm going to put everything in the urine and I'm going to take back what I want. It's sort of like taking everything down to the op shop and then changing your mind, you know? So I'm going to get rid of it. No, I'm going to keep that one. That's a really sexy number. So the hormones, they're measuring it in the urine, which is what the kidney doesn't want, right? Now, and it's the same in the blood. If you did a serum progesterone on someone who's taking transdermal progesterone, the level is zero. You don't see it. And the reason is that progesterone, when you apply it transdermally, is carried on the red blood cells. So where do the red blood cells go? Oh, they go all 80 trillion cells, don't they? And what do? They hang around and go, no, I'm going to send it into the serum because that would be the really dumbest thing to do, or I'm going to transfer it into the cell where it's actually going to do something. And people have made this mistake before, and I'm sure he's a very reputable scientist, but he doesn't realize that transdermal progesterone is carried on red cells, and you will not see it in serum, and you will not see it in the urine. Okay? It's see it in the cell. So if you want to verify that your progesterone is working, you do a saliva test. Because it couldn't get into the saliva if it hadn't gone through the capillaries to the parotid gland and then being excreted that way. So salivary testing is a better way of testing progesterone therapeutics.
No matter where you put that progesterone, let's say you were putting it vaginally or interlabially or down below your belly button, it's still going to show up in salivary tests because it just gets into that. Okay.
Absolutely. Because that blood, let's say you're doing it around the belly button, the arteries come from like, I think, no, there might be a separate layer for the arteries. You know, when you, if you operate on someone and you cut, they bleed. Well, you know, that, so the, those vessels are also taking venous stuff back through the system. So they don't go down to the perineum. They go back up into the heart through the inferior vena cava and get sort of pumped around almost randomly. So the other, all 80 trillion cells are going to get it. You know, it depends. The brain might not, if it's not micronized, but the rest of it will. Yeah. So that's that. I mean, that bothered me for a long time as well. What, why? What's going on here? I think it was John Ali who said that he, in one of his, I've got an old cassette tape of him, and he actually was talking about this back in the 70s. He says, "What the doctors say? Oh, your progesterone isn't working because it's, you know, transdermal doesn't work." I said, "Well, where are you measuring it?" Yeah.
It just seems so.
Yeah.
I did a just not too long ago. I did a series of tests. I had some doctors help me out with this and donate the test: a 24-hour urine, a blood spot, a Dutch dried urine, blood serum, and I did a. I don't know if you know about the steroid tissue analysis. It's like HTMA, but they run your steroid hormones through hair and nail. I did my hair and my nails, and through my friend who's a researcher, Georgie Dinkoff, who runs these, who's doing these labs and offering them for people. And I did those labs, except for the tissue analysis, of course. That was over the course of 3 months worth of hair and nail. But the other labs I did all in 24-hour period. I did not do saliva, and now I could kick myself for that. But we did that, and it was crazy. And they likened it to a Jackson Pollock painting, like, you know, like who the hell knows what's going on here? It depends on who's looking at it. Because if I would have gone to the blood spot person, they would have given me, you know, DHEA. If I would have gone to the blood serum person, they would have given me everything. And so we had a good laugh at all of
Yeah.
it.
Can I ask you, so there was no progesterone in any of your in your hair samples at all? Is that
No, there. So there was in the hair samples. But there
oh,
was
okay.
100 times more estradiol than normal, and I was already in menopause at this point. in the tissues. So then he took nail samples because he's like, let's confirm this. And I was talking to Carol Peterson. I don't know if you know who she is. She's a wonderful pharmacist who's just a big advocate for progesterone. And she said, well, that's excretion, you know, like it would be interesting to get a biopsy from breast tissue or whatever to see, to then correlate it all. But who's going to do that? And I mean, I would, but what doctor will allow
You
me?
could maybe do it from fat cells. Do a fat biopsy. You'd
So would
find
a fat
yeah.
biopsy? Yeah, I mean, I don't know what doctor's going to say yes to that.
Well, anyone who's measuring for DDT, so, you know, EPA type doctors, they're doing it.
Well, so the tissue guy was saying, why don't I take some dried skin cells from like under the breast, like from a pumice stone, and we can check that, because I definitely feel like I'm, you know, estrogen heavy up here and always have been. So, but it was so fascinating, and it was vastly different from, but the one that made the most sense was the tissue. So it was just interesting to find that out.
It is possible that people excrete things in organs that might not be, well understood. I'll give you an example. Copper is excreted in the hair when it's in excess. And this is why hair sample parts per millions correlate very well with liver biopsies. Okay. So, but none of the other minerals are excreted in the hair. So, for instance, sodium, you wee that out. Potassium, you wee that out. Calcium, you wee it out. Magnesium, you wee them out. And copper, you might wee, but copper.
So, when you get the
also...
HTMA lab, why? How is that measuring potassium and everything?
Yeah, it measures all of them because they're in the matrix of the hair, which reflects the skin cells that are making that matrix. So it's a mirror image of what they're doing.
Oh,
and yeah. So, for instance, and that's why a metal that will be excreted by the skin. Let's say you've got lead in your system, and you've got all these estrogens, and you go see the liver, and the liver's going to say, "Can't you see I'm busy? Go see the skin." So the lead goes somewhere else and comes out in the skin or the urine, whatever. So it'll be shed on skin cells. But copper is one of those things that can be excreted in the hair. You can dump your excess copper in the hair, but you won't do that for, you know, boron, sodium, potassium, you know, iron, all those things. So it's an unusual mineral in that. So sometimes when you see copper coming out in hair samples, it's because you're getting rid of it. And that is often because your liver has run out of glutathione. And one of the things about these standard liver pathways is that no one has really checked what happens when they go wrong. I'll give you an example. If your copper is really high, ordinarily it doesn't use glutathione to make an exit. That's relegated to the, you know, arsenic and all these other things, mercury, aluminium, whatever. But when the copper is high, it then steals the glutathione pathway at the expense of the other toxic metals and says, look, I'm the priority. I'm going to use your stuff. It's a bit like a sibling saying, I'm going to use your laptop. Mm-hmm. You know, that means that, you know, the kid can't use it, the other one. So the same thing happens with copper. So if the liver's had enough and said, well, you've got used all my glutathione, just bugger off, it's going to go out through the hair. And we notice that, yes, because it's another exit, and go, oh, and the liver didn't want me. I'm going to go somewhere else. You know?
Interesting.
Yeah. So you've got to really look at those things. What is going on here? What's the context of it? Is it copper overload? Is it because there's chronic inflammation? Is it because there's an infection that's going on all the time and I need the copper that high?
Oh.
Is it peripubertal? Is the person on an oral contraceptive pill? Are they actually excreting copper to get rid of it? So there's a lot of reasons why. Yeah.
Huh. So when someone says you have copper excess and they're trying to bring your copper down, but you've got an infection that your copper's trying to manage, that would be a poor choice of treatment.
You've got to figure out why. So don't blame the test. If somebody has high blood sugar, do we blame every glucose molecule on the planet for the problem?
Yes,
is
they
that
do.
Really, the problem is it really? Oh, glucose. Oh, sugar is bad. Look, see, your sugar is high. We should be going, well, why the hell is it high? Why is it high? We should treat the why. The same with the copper or any abnormal test when it comes back. they're often not diagnostic in themselves. They're just a segue to figuring out something else. And if you've got enough of these anomalies, the anomalies actually look like a pattern. And, that's what John R. Lee's brilliance was. That's why he was a genius, because he could see the anomalies and he figured out the pattern. And generally, medical doctors don't like that.
The
They're very
one thing
linear.
I didn't like about Dr. Lee was that he wasn't big on megadosing progesterone, and I wouldn't probably be here if I hadn't discovered Ray White's site and started doing 800 milligrams. I mean, I was doing
Can I make a
3%.
suggestion why that was? Self-doubt. And I think that's the reason why he didn't publish. It was self-doubt. He had an element, you could see it in his posture and his gesture. He had the confidence, but there was something, some, not that he wasn't authentic, because I loved him. I thought he was just the bee's knees. But there was some self-doubt in him that maybe he got it wrong and someone was going to pick up an inconsistency. And
Interesting. Well, I
yeah,
don't fault him for that. That's for sure. I don't. Because he paved the way, didn't he? And
Oh,
the
absolutely.
Ray Peets, the John Lees, the Ray Peets, these people really just paved the way for people like now, where we have all this access to this information, and we're not doing the, what did you say, the sanitized version of the studies and the data and the science. We're looking at these, they're shedding light on stuff that people had overlooked, which is just really just brilliant. Gosh, I just loved this so much. And the one project, I just don't want to take up more of your time, but I do want to say, how do we get this book? The
I know there are some of them on, Amazon and Barnes and Noble, because it's been out
okay.
of print for a while. We're in the process of
Okay.
reprinting them.
Okay.
What I might do is just send you a personal DM about, a way of getting around that, because I actually
Okay.
still have all these books on PDF.
Okay.
So
And now with Telemed, I know you have a wellness center, right? And so with Telemed, you see people from all over the world now. Is that correct? Okay. And so I'm going to just share that info in the show notes, but also just shed light on that in our group. So you might get bombarded, which I hope you do. But I'd love to have you back also, put you on the spot now and ask you to come back another time so we can dig into things
Well,
like
I
dental and
was
stuff.
thinking we never got to talk about the microbiome. So did you want me to maybe do something about the hormone, where the microbiome fits into this hormone thing? Because
Sure.
that's sort of emerging as well. And
Yes.
every time I look at that, they've invented another one. Oh, did you know there's an ear canal microbiome? No.
I'm actually
But
writing an article now for a Substack that's about the gut and hormones and insulin resistance and cortisol and the life cycle of cortisol in the gut. So yeah, I'd love for you to speak on that, and then I can put that in my Substack and quote you.
Because I know you were trying to get there, and I'm sorry if I deflected you,
Oh no,
but
I mean,
that's like
I
another rabbit
literally.
hole,
I have a
and
list of directions that we could have gone.
good for you, good for you.
I'm telling you, I have podcasts and sometimes they're so good. And I think that's the best guest I've ever had. And that's it. It's going to be downhill from now, just because I don't think that someone could be that good again. You know what I mean? And he was so good. That was just incredible. We were all over the map. I'm sure you caught that. We were definitely talking about a lot of different things, but I'm sure, just listen to it again. I listened to it 4 times already. And he's going to be back, and we're going to talk about gut health and hormones. And okay, so thank you. And he has not sent me the information about his books, because I don't think that they're going to be in print again for a while. So unfortunately, I can't even give you that excerpt I read earlier. So you can just maybe get the transcript from it, I guess, if you want it. Also, Kitty Bloomfield is going to do a live Facebook Live with me this Friday. Okay, it's at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. It's going to be amazing. We have a couple of giveaways. We have a coupon code that's only good for 12 hours. So you have to come and listen to the live in the estrogen dominant support group in order to get the coupon, which is going to be a huge amount off on anything at Ona's. And we're also going to do a little giveaway. So we're going to talk about pro-metabolic stuff and weightlifting and getting into perimenopause and menopause and how to do that gracefully. And if the Ray PD metabolic stuff isn't working for you, and she's going to have some answers for us, and we're going to put her in the corner and ask her what's up with dairy, what's up with orange juice, what's up with Coca-Cola, yada yada. And that's it. So exciting stuff coming on, coming up. And thank you for joining me with Dr. Jabrizian. He is for hire, guys. So if you want to work with him on your health, you can also get that information in the show notes.